The roundup is heading back to school, and we hope we'll get an A grade today, the kind that all our region's four public school districts just received. Can they repeat? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. We're going to devote the next hour to picking the brains of the superintendents of South Florida's three largest school systems, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. And while they're all feeling pretty good about those top marks, they've got challenges ahead in the new school year that starts next week. Yeah, already. Whatever happened to summer vacation? Among them, stiff competition from private and charter schools, and this new thing called AI. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bemvindo. Let's start this week's show by acknowledging a difficult reality. Public primary and secondary education in this country may be slowly but surely going out of fashion. Assign whatever political or cultural reason you want to it, but the fact is that while 83% of U.S. kids still attend public schools, that's down from 87% just 3 years ago. The rise of charter schools and universal vouchers for private schools means public schools have stiffer competition than ever, and they gotta start adjusting to it. South Florida's public school districts are scrambling to improve their product in the education marketplace, so in the next hour we'll hear from the superintendents of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. Monroe County superintendent was unavailable. First up is a conversation WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri and I had with Miami-Dade Superintendent Jose Dotres about everything from a historically difficult budget to historically unprecedented AI instruction. Thanks very much for your time, Dr. Dotres.
My pleasure.
I want to start with what I think has been on the mind of every public school administrator, teacher, and parent this summer, and that's money. The Trump administration had halted $5 billion in federal public school funding, including $45 million for Miami-Dade schools, and that was only restored last week. This year's extended state legislature session added to the cliffhanger atmosphere. Your chief financial officer recently said that putting together this year's budget was, quote, historically difficult. How is all this going to affect life in the classroom this year?
Well, it was historically difficult because we had to make some reductions, but I'll tell you, the relief of making sure that the federal funds are now unfrozen and released has really given us an opportunity to generate and start up all the plans that we had for the multiple programs attached to those federal dollars, which included bilingual education, all of our enrichment programs, the extensive professional development that we do with teachers, the adult programs that we have as well. The plans that we had will be in full effect once school begins.
Dr. Dotres, a looming factor in the budget conversation is declining enrollment, especially related to the boom these days in school choice, like private and charter schools. I know the school board recently voted to explore the possibility of transforming under-enrolled schools into pre-K learning centers. How deeply are Miami-Dade public schools being affected by this trend, and how can you reverse it? Can it be reversed?
I would not want to just say that the trends are related to charter schools and private schools because the growth in number in charter schools is literally not there. There are other factors that are playing into enrollment issues, which I think other school districts as well, which is the high cost in Miami-Dade is prompting families to leave. You know that. And in fact, some other school districts are reflecting incredible growth because of the movement out of these larger urban areas. We absolutely are making way for inviting private providers of pre-K to consider coming and being in our buildings. And that is a trend that we hope to establish for two reasons. Number one, the obvious, right? students will be better prepared for their formal kindergarten year and school when they start early. But second, which impacts the economy, and sometimes that's what we are trying to communicate, when daycare is expensive or parents cannot afford it, they stay home, and therefore they're not part of the workforce, they're not contributing to the economy. And then another aspect that worries me is when they stay home, parents that may need retooling, upskilling, attending university or technical colleges, that doesn't occur either. Our ability to bring private pre-K providers into our buildings provides, in my opinion, an opportunity for these children to have a better setting than sometimes where they're at. Ultimately, it also creates a pipeline of students for our schools if they start early in our site.
Speaking of staying home, there's been a fear this past school year that undocumented children or children of undocumented parents may be avoiding going to school because of President Trump's deportation crackdown. Is this an absenteeism that could be concerning to you?
You know, we monitored that last year, and we did not see extreme or issues of attendance. You know, our schools are a safe place for students. We really have not had any incidents here in Miami-Dade County.
But even as Miami-Dade faces declining enrollment, it's also been confronting a teacher shortage. You've hired over 300 new teachers for this academic year, and you've noted that a lot of them aren't products of, say, conventional undergraduate education programs, but rather they are experts in certain fields making a career change to teaching. And as a result, they're going to need more teacher training and mentoring than usual. Is this becoming the norm in terms of teacher enrollment, do you think?
100%. I was one of those career changers myself, but when I changed careers, right, from being a field auditor to becoming a teacher, the majority of the teachers that were hired were from colleges of education. Now we're living in the reverse world where colleges of education are not producing or graduating sufficient number of teachers. So we are seeing an increase, I mean, of the professionals that we're hiring into teaching for the first time. We have 60% of them having teaching as a new career for them, either career changers or recent college graduates that come from the fields of mathematics, engineering, science, healthcare. So we are attracting more and more individuals from across the disciplines. And absolutely, as a result of that, then we have to provide the pedagogical support that new teachers will need. In fact, this week, we're going through our 4-day teacher induction program to strengthen those skill sets before our brand new teachers enter the classroom.
Turning from teachers to a new tool that may or may not help teachers, artificial intelligence. Miami-Dade Public Schools is right now undergoing the country's largest deployment of classroom AI tools with Gemini, Google's AI chatbot. You're also opening 3 new so-called AI academies. Is AI a path to student performance enhancement, or is it, as it's often used, a path to student cheating and misinformation? What is the bet the district is making here?
We're making the bet that, number one, we are selecting a tool, Gemini, like you referred to, that has been vetted, has been looked at, has been monitored before we implemented, so that the tool is used as one that can help students cascade instruction and is able to, like, for example, walk a student through a math problem. An AI tool is no longer the future, it is now. So we have to be able to help our students utilize this tool to maximize learning in a way that it deepens their understanding or content amount, but they also have to understand what's true, what's not true, and teach them that what you get from AI, you have to make it yours and you have to compose it to your own understanding. Now, the real power of AI is this. There is an element in teaching and learning that is called students having misconceptions. So if a student has certain misconceptions in a topic, right, through an AI tool, it can identify those areas of deficiencies very clearly. And therefore, the instruction or the intervention that a student may require is identified early and can be done very deliberately to that area versus participating in a lesson and not necessarily that deficit being addressed. To me, that is the most powerful element of AI because it delivers individualized instruction for the students. AI has also become extremely important for students with disabilities, whether it is verbal supports or using it for them to understand what they're trying to learn. It's becoming quite an important element.
Well, in helping identify those weaknesses and helping a student through a math problem, like you said, isn't that the teacher's job, what they're there to do?
Of course, the teacher is there, but the teacher also has some other students, and students vary in need. So although teachers provide individualized opportunities, small group instruction, right, interventions, this added tool really hones in on specific areas of misconception that really facilitates the process. We are not only utilizing AI to support instruction, we're also utilizing AI to support teaching and maybe reducing the amount of tasks that sometimes teachers have to perform that may take away from instructional time. We're providing a lot of training guidelines of how to apply them in the classroom.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri and I are speaking with the Miami-Dade Public School Superintendent Jose Dotres about the unusual challenges ahead of this year, from a historically difficult budget making to historically unprecedented AI adoption. And speaking of new technology, Dr. Dotres, can you tell us about the new telehealth tech the district recently incorporated, especially the augmented student mental health services that includes? How do students access it, for example?
Sure. Thrilled to speak to you about that. So we have telehealth available across all of our schools during the school day and up to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And then during the summers, we had telehealth services available for all our students. It is quite simple. A parent has to register for the telehealth option. And then if a student, for example, is sick in the school or a small illness occurs, with parent permission, they go to the clinic. The clinic connects the child to a screen with a doctor. The parent can be on the line as well in the conference, and even medication can be prescribed right on the spot at the school, certain medications,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Now we've always had it as part of telehealth. There's a mental health component. This is also really important, very helpful, because sometimes I get concerned, okay, so once the students finish their school day, sometimes 2 o'clock for elementary or 3 o'clock, right, when students go home, or in high school finishes early, right? And during the summers and after hours, you know, what if a parent has a need for mental health supports for their child?
Right.
Through telehealth, they're able to access it.
Dr. Dotres, we were just talking about teachers and AI, but we also wanted to ask you about teachers and testing, another big elephant in the classroom. On the one hand, it's certainly good news that Miami-Dade Public Schools recently received an A grade for the sixth year in a row. Plus, none of the district schools themselves received an F. Those grades are determined through the Florida Assessment of Student Thinking, or FAST, test, which is administered 3 times a year. It makes me wonder, do teachers feel that to get those grade ratings, they're just superficially teaching to a test, or do they consider it an asset to have multiple standardized tests in one year?
We went from a once a year at the end of the year one-time test to three formative assessments during the year. Why is it so different? And why is it so helpful? And why is it that we believe that this is contributing to our students progressing better? A teacher has the ability to adjust instruction immediately based on the results of the students in what we call progress monitoring one and progress monitoring two. Prior to that, there were a lot of assessments that were introduced throughout the year to capture where the students are. I believe that the pivot that the state did in order to provide progress monitoring and not relying on just one exam at the end has really improved the ability of teachers to adjust and do real-time instruction.
Dr. Dotres, next month, the district is going to discuss whether to change the name of its Diversity, Equity, and Excellence Advisory Committee to something with less of a DEI target on its back, like the Education Opportunity and Access Advisory Committee. This is obviously an effort to steer clear of President Trump's and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's campaigns to eradicate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in institutions like schools. But what, to your mind, are some of the most important DEI-related programs that Miami-Dade schools have that could be at risk?
No, listen, the name change, if it's done to be in line with state requirements and such forth, is not going to change the requirements of that committee. That committee looks at all groups. It looks at all subgroups of students regarding how they're performing, patterns of needs, facilities. So the essence of the role of that group does not change. And we in the school district, we will continue to provide the supports and the instruction that all students need. When we look at the performance of our subgroups, the subgroup of Hispanic, the subgroup of African American, the subgroup of students with disability, the subgroup of students with English as a second language, and the subgroup of students economically disadvantaged, all of those proficiency levels have increased. We adapt, we change, and we put the supports in place that all different groups of students or subgroups may require.
Speaking of inclusion programs, Miami-Dade schools almost lost the popular citizenship education courses for immigrants going through the naturalization process after federal funding cuts threatened the program. It was rescued when Miami District 4 Commissioner Ralph Rosado announced his office would allocate up to $10,000 to subsidize the courses offered through the district's adult education program. And on top of that, the Homeland Security Department says the courses are no longer a priority for America. But in a place like Miami, it seems hard for these courses to not be treated like a priority, doesn't it?
Sure, Miami needs citizenship courses, but let me also clarify. The federal funds for the fast-track citizenship courses that were offered in our adult ed centers were expired or they were removed in March, much earlier than the frozen federal dollars. Now, prior to the federal government providing funding for these, what they labeled fast track citizenship classes, the state used to fund all those classes. Once we did not have the federal funds for them, what we did is we went into a fee-based process for any individuals that wanted to take citizenship classes to still take them, and we still offer them. What is interesting, and sometimes it gets lost in translation, that the enrollment that we had in the fast track was less than the enrollment that we have now in our fee-based adult education classes, that they're not very costly. So the citizenship classes were really never at risk or eliminated. It's just how they were funded and how we were doing them.
And finally, despite all the talk of budget cutbacks, we're hearing that Miami-Dade schools, unlike, for example, Broward Public Schools to the north, will continue its free schools breakfast and lunch program. Why did you make that decision?
We made that decision because free breakfast and free lunch is really important for all of our students. The continuity is important. We really worry about the nourishment of our students, making sure that they are participating in breakfast, that they are participating in lunch, you know? And I have to tell you, that's part of the reasons why we're the best choice.
That was our conversation earlier this week with Miami-Dade Public Schools Superintendent Jose Dotres. Still to come, our live conversation with Broward County's public schools boss. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Among South Florida public schools districts, Broward County's has undoubtedly had the roughest time in recent years. School board scandals, including a state grand jury investigation, a revolving door at the superintendent's office, and a steep enrollment decline, among other challenges, made it harder to focus on the classroom. But under former Superintendent Peter Licata and his successor, current Superintendent Howard Hepburn, Broward has moved the school's train back on the rails. The district just received its second statewide A grade in a row, and none of its schools themselves received a D or F grade. To be sure, school closures are still a reality. Some controversies remain a distraction, like, well, just this week, the banning of more than 50 books from public schools' libraries, and now Florida's DOGE may be looking into laptop contracts. But Superintendent Hepburn is confidently pushing ahead with the district's big Redefining Broward County Public Schools initiative. Broward School Superintendent Howard Hepburn now joins me and WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri on this eve of the new academic year. Dr. Hepburn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tim. Happy to be here.
Do you have a question for Superintendent Hepburn? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Dr. Hepburn, one of the big issues for public school districts today is how you need to market yourselves to compete with the rise of charter and private schools amid a declining number of student customers, as it were. On the Broward Public Schools website, you say your principles are, quote, empathy, culture, value, and aggregate efficiency. That last one might sound a little academic to folks, but just briefly, we'd like to hear a little more about your education philosophy and how it applies to, as I said, marketing what is the sixth largest public school system in the country.
Absolutely. My leadership style, I'm a servant leader. It's about the kids in the community that we serve every day and empowering everybody, you know, not just the people who work in our schools or in our district offices, but also the community and parents to help us with tough decisions that we're going to leverage in our classrooms to make our classrooms better, that equate to better learning opportunities for our students. So absolutely, you know, we're student centered. We're focused and prioritizing every decision we make and how it's going to have an impact on our students first. And then everything else is secondary to that.
Hi, Dr. Hepburn. One of the things you just said, we focus on the students. I hear you say it so often, but I'm wondering if that North Star has gotten harder to follow as politics has come to dominate Florida education policy. Just this week, as Tim mentioned, we learned that Broward County Public Schools had to remove 55 books from its libraries under state pressure to ban material considered sexually explicit or otherwise inappropriate for minors. Any material considered politically woke is also under intense scrutiny. How difficult does all of this make it to stay focused on the students?
Well, I think it's the opposite. Staying focused on our priority, which is our kids, actually makes it easy. It makes it easy for us to ignore all the noise and banter out there. It helps my team direct their individual teams better to really concentrate on the needs of our kids. And that's how we got to our back-to-back A's, is focusing on our kids and not and ignoring all the extracurricular noise that is a constant, in the realm of public education, probably for the past 5+ years. So it makes our decision making, it makes our implementation of what we need to do for our kids actually easier.
And Dr. Hepburn, regarding that book removal controversy this week, we just wanted to play a quote here from Stefana Farrell, a school parent and president of the nonprofit Florida Freedom to Read Project, about the process behind these book removals.
There's no opportunity for local parents to get involved. None of it matters. The state has decided for us.
So we just wanted to ask you, does she have a point that parents themselves in reality don't much have much input in all of this?
I think that's a reality. We try to involve parents as much as possible in everything in the learning process or education process for our students. I know our local legislators are always engaging with our community members. That includes parents. And I think they need to leverage those opportunities even more to voice those concerns to our local legislators to make sure they have the right amount of advocacy up in the state capitol and also in DC as well.
And just really quickly, I know one big question parents have is one of the other realities of this, that there is book removals for, say, primary school students, but yet another criteria for book removals when it comes to secondary high school age students. Is that part of the process?
Well, our process here in Broward County, as well as many other school districts, is besides what the state dictates is what should be on our shelves or in our classrooms, we do have another process where if there are materials in our classrooms or in our shelves, that parents do have the opportunity to challenge those materials, and they're pulled for review with a specific committee to review every word, every letter to identify if it's appropriate for the grade level that it's in. And so we've done that in the past where we'll make shifts to certain grade levels where it's most appropriate, or even remove it if that committee deems so.
Dr. Hepburn, Florida's new Commissioner of Education, Anastasios Kamoutsas, paid you and the district a visit yesterday. Can you tell us about takeaways from your meeting? I'm curious to know if the state's and his emphasis on parental rights in education and school choice causes friction with Broward's efforts to make public education parents' top choice.
Yeah, we had a great visit from the Commissioner of Education yesterday. We were able to showcase why we're an A school district. We went over some tangible deliverables with the commissioner. We actually visited a few of our schools. You had some great discussions about what we do and how we do it and who we're doing it for, which is ultimately for our students. So we've built some great relationships with the commissioner as well as other state officials to continue to support Broward County Public Schools, because our mission is strong and firm, is to ensure that our students are meeting and exceeding their potential. So all in all, it was a great visit, and we were able to showcase what we're doing here in Broward County, which is a lot of great things for the community and for our kids, and I think he was pleased with our visit.
Well, talking about what you're showcasing, since you took on this job last year, your contract has been extended another 5 years. Congratulations, by the way. What do you consider the biggest challenge or challenges ahead of you in those next 5 years, starting with the new year that starts on Monday?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was very important that I pursue an extension to my contract. Many of the initiatives that we're trying to implement is going to take time to ensure that implementation is done in a way that's, provides some satisfaction to our community, some value to our communities, parents and students. I think the largest thing on our plate right now is what we call redefining Broward County Public Schools, and we're in phase two of that. Our footprint is very large. We've lost a lot of students over the past decade, and we need to reduce our footprint in the county and right-size ourselves so we can be as efficient as possible and provide even more to our students in the process. So we're on that journey again. We're going to start in the fall again, talking with our municipality and city leaders, talking to our nonprofit and for-profit partners, talking to our communities once again, and going out and discussing the realities of our situation and working together to come up with the best solution possible for our local communities and also Broward County Public Schools.
As we discussed with Miami-Dade Superintendent Dotrice, money is perhaps the biggest anxiety for public schools. Until recently, President Trump had frozen about $28 million in federal funds for Broward Public Schools. You had mentioned that if it wasn't unfrozen, you'd have an action plan to compensate. Just out of curiosity, let's say the president next year keeps those funds frozen, and that's certainly not a remote possibility. What would be the action plan in that case?
Well, luckily those funds were unfrozen, so we're not in the situation that we thought we were going to be in if they were not. Pretty much the action plan was to go through our current vacancies and see what employees we could shift in those current vacancies. Really look at how we're providing services to ensure that we're compliant with federal and state laws. And so we were looking at most of our vacancies to shift personnel into. That was the biggest part of the action plan that we were going to implement to avoid furloughing or laying off any individuals. So we're going to be doing a lot of efficiency studies and shifts just to make sure we're utilizing our budget accordingly and not wasting taxpayers' dollars. So we're constantly in that mindset of looking how we can improve our processes, improve the services that we're providing to our schools and to our. So that's a constant for us. So yeah. It just accelerated that process this summer when we got that news.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri and I are speaking with Broward Public School Superintendent Howard Hepburn about the challenges ahead in the new school year that starts next week. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Dr. Hepburn, regarding the money angle you and Natalie were just discussing, last week, Florida Attorney General James Othmeyer warned that the Broward Public Schools District spending may now be part of the state's new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. He presumably meant a new $115 million deal for take-home laptop computers. Are you concerned that Florida's DOGE really will look into Broward schools' finances the way it's auditing the Broward County government?
No, there's no concern. I actually welcome the state or the AG's or CFO's office to come down. We're always on a journey of efficiency, as I spoke about before. Our replenishment or refreshment program for electronic devices, specifically laptops and desktops, that's actually a routine thing for school districts. And we're a very large school district servicing a couple of 100,000 students. So when you equate that to the number of laptops that will be needed for each student, and also faculty and staff, that number becomes enormous. So, you know, that contract's going to be over $100 million for 5 years. So that's about $20 million a year to replenish devices that are past their useful life, devices that are out of warranty, that are breaking apart. As people who in their own homes that own electronic devices, we know that they get outdated very quickly and they don't function well. They start falling apart. You're out of warranty, know, it costs a lot of money to actually fix them, so it's cheaper to replace. Right. So those are routine things that most school districts do, just like us.
We, of course, also wanted to ask you about the status of the ongoing Redefining Our Schools project. A lot of that has to do with repurposing campuses, but also actually closing a number of public schools in Broward County. This has gotten quite the pushback, especially from the Broward Estates Elementary community, where the campus will now be an early learning center. What do you say to families out there in terms of staying on course and having faith in the long-term benefits of the program?
Yes, it is a difficult decision for any community when we talk about closing schools, but it's a action that we have to take to really right-size our district so we can do better things for our students. I want the public to really understand that when you're in an under-enrolled school or severely under-enrolled school, you're spending a lot of money on operations and maintenance of an under-enrolled school, especially if that school is built in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s, because there's constant repair. And so we're not, in those type of schools, we're not maximizing the amount of money that's coming to that school because we're spending a lot of it on operations and maintenance
right.
for for the school instead of students.
Dr. Hepburn, obviously, ever since the Parkland mass shooting tragedy in 2018, student security has been a perennial concern in Broward County schools. One of the biggest budget areas to suffer cuts this year, however, was security, including campus monitors. Last year, Broward students started walking through metal detectors to enter school, and we hear those are sticking around this year. Can you give us an update on these and other security measures?
Yes, absolutely. I want to correct the record there. There hasn't been any decrease in budget for security. As I mentioned before, we've lost thousands of students over the past 10 years. So we've pretty much right-sized our allocation of security personnel to schools. So we can't continue to staff schools as if they were, as if they had their enrollment that they had 5 or 10 years ago. So it's comparable. Right. To the number of students that are in the school. But besides the metal or weapon detection systems that we're utilizing in all of our high schools, and as well as the Alyssa's Alert app that people are familiar with Safer Watch on their cell phones, and we have it on our desktops and laptops, this year we're adding an additional layer of safety with Syntegix Crisis Alert Badge. It's the same size as an ID that you would wear on your lanyard. And so every last one of our staff members will have one of those crisis alert badges. So in the instance of an emergency, could be a medical emergency or student conflict issue, they can click that several times to get a response from administration on their campus. If there is a threat to campus that they've observed or think is happening, they can continue to click, 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 and they get a quick response from local law enforcement, an immediate response. Every second and every minute counts.
Right. No, that's interesting. And although this isn't a security measure per se, what about the cell phone ban that was established last year to keep students' attention more focused on their classroom work and less on their TikTok accounts?
Yes, absolutely. So the policy that was implemented last year will start at the beginning of this school year again. And it's more so to ensure that our students, you know, are going back to the basics with socializing with each other. I communicate with industry partners all the time. And one of the things they ask us about all the time is those soft skills for our students. They don't know how to engage with each other socially in that business environment and that collaborative environment.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and we're trying to get back to the basics to help students understand how to socialize with each other in an educational environment, in a cafeteria, things like that. So we have a lot of pluses from that policy from last year. Student conflict issues have gone down, and performance, of course, has certainly reached new heights.
Finally, Dr. Hepburn, the district earned its second consecutive A grade this year. And we should mention the A the district received last year under your new leadership was its first in more than a decade. What were the key steps implemented to get there, and what will we see more of this year?
It's simple. As I said when we started the call, it's really focusing on our students. Every decision that we make, we keep students at the forefront. We utilize a lot of performance data throughout the year to really understand the gaps for our students and give them the right dose of instruction to help them excel and exceed their potential throughout the year. Our teachers are doing a great job in the classroom, where everyone is taking pride to ensure that no student fails, right? They take a lot of pride, and they go above and beyond to make sure students are getting what they need so they don't fail. And we converse a lot with our principals about the resources that they may need to continue to extend opportunities inside and outside of the classroom too. So it's not a complex strategy. It's very simple. And it's not just about what's happening in our buildings. We have tons of volunteers. Right. Our bus drivers, custodians, food service workers,
and we do appreciate that work, but we're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Hepburn, for time, unfortunately. Howard Hepburn is superintendent of Broward County Public Schools. Dr. Hepburn, many thanks. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, our education reporter engages Palm Beach County's superintendent. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We've been devoting this week's show to a preview of the new school year that starts next week. Our call letters, after all, are LRN for learn. And we've just heard from the Miami-Dade and Broward County Public School Superintendents. We want to shift now to Palm Beach County and its school superintendent, Michael Burke, who can also brag about an A grade this year for his district. And unlike its counterparts to the south, Palm Beach is not experiencing a decline in enrollment. But like Miami-Dade and Broward, Palm Beach schools, too, are facing the artificial intelligence challenge in the form of new AI instruction tool called Conmigo. WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri spoke earlier this week with Palm Beach County Public School Superintendent Michael Burke about that and a host of other subjects. Here's their conversation.
I first wanted to talk about the A rating that the district received. Second straight year that it receives an A rating and fifth overall since 2017 to the 18 school year. And more than 90 schools of the total 183 in the district received A's. What went into the plan on bouncing back from the pandemic when children were falling behind in their academics?
Yes, well, we're really proud of the A as well. And a lot goes into it. You know, our teachers and our students working really hard in the classroom every day. Some of the things that we're really focused on and that we've been working on for years really is first making sure that kids have access to rigorous coursework. So it starts in elementary school with an accelerated math program. In middle school, we have students taking high school level courses, and then high school taking college level courses. Last year's graduating class, the class of 2025, 79% of the seniors took at least one college level course. And then we really had a heavy emphasis last year on early literacy and making sure that we're emphasizing phonics-based instruction. So we did a lot of work in our elementary schools. We've partnered with the University of Florida's Lassinger Institute, which helps train teachers in the science of reading, how students learn how to read. Our algebra scores went up. We're up to like 60% now, pass rate up from 47% a few years ago for students to take the Algebra 1 exam for the first time. And like you said, we had 120 of our schools earned an A or B, which is up from 113 the year before. We have no DRF, district-operated schools, which we're proud of. We did have some D schools 2 years ago, and those schools worked hard to get up to a C or better. And then we had two schools that really stood out. We had Pine Jog Elementary School and Rosenwald Elementary School that rose from a C to an A last school year.
That's great. And the early literacy really caught my attention here. I understand also that the district has a collaboration with the Coalition of Learning Literacy that goes into at-risk schools and really helps through the AmeriCorps program, I believe. So I guess what I'm getting at is kind of the community involvement that has also gone into strengthening early learning literacy.
Yes. I mean, we're fortunate in Palm Beach County. We enjoy a lot of support from our community and business partners, and it's, you know, it's all hands on deck, and we take advantage of whatever additional help people can bring to the table. As a district, we also purchased more curriculum. We use a product called UFLY, which again is out of the University of Florida. We use a product called Foundations. Those were both early literacy curriculum materials. And then it's, you know, really just comes down to our teachers and our students. I mean, they're the ones doing the work there in the classroom.
I wanted to ask you too about under enrollment, actually, which is not nearly as much as what Broward and Miami-Dade are experiencing. Do you have any thoughts on why Palm Beach hasn't been as strongly affected by that?
In Palm Beach County, our motto is your best choice. So we work hard to live up to that because, you know, families do have more choices than ever with charter schools, now private schools with the universal vouchers or family empowerment scholarships, virtual education, home education. So we really work hard to try to provide the complete educational experience. So we want the rigorous academics, we want athletic programs, music, extracurricular activities, all of that, all those components that make for a great experience. And we're hanging on to our students. You know, if I look at Palm Beach County, we're serving over 76% of the students in Palm Beach County when you compare us to charters and the vouchers. And that is higher, I think, than if I look to a couple of counties to our south. But it is a challenge, I will say, with the passage of the Family Empowerment Scholarships, regardless of income level, that program is growing exponentially. We've got about 30,000 students now in Palm Beach County that are receiving a voucher. Many of those students were already in private school before that program was created. So we never really lost them. They're just now getting, you know, taxpayer dollars to help pay their tuition. But like you said, the competition is fierce. Families have a lot of options. And one thing is, I think that's also kind of unique in Palm Beach County is we have a really robust choice program with over 330 choice programs so that students and their parents they have options beyond just their boundary home school. If there's a program that interests them, you know, if they want to go to a pre-law academy or medical sciences or engineering or IT or you name it, they can apply to those choice programs and go to school in, you know, in other parts of the county.
Speaking of classroom and student readiness, I also wanted to ask you about how the district has embraced artificial intelligence with Conmigo AI in high schools and middle schools. How is incorporating AI into classrooms to the benefit of students for their life after graduating?
We've had a great partnership with the Stiles Nicholson Foundation. They are underwriting 50% of the cost of this Conmigo that we are now going into our second school year, where every middle and high school student will have Conmigo, which, as you know, is the AI assistant, like a chatbot type assistant. There's also a teacher version that all of our teachers have throughout Palm Beach County. I feel like we need to embrace this as a tool that our students are going to be expected to know how to use when they hit the workforce. So this Conmigo has allowed us to do this in a way that's safe, because Conmigo draws its knowledge from the Khan Academy content. So you don't have to worry about it picking up like erroneous information on the internet. You know, using the chatbot or using any of these AI, I guess, your products, I think it's important that students develop the higher order thinking, where they know how to set the parameters of their question or search and kind of drill down to the relevant information, and they can start using that skill set, because it is when they get to college or even beyond into the career, I think their employers are going to expect them to be well versed in AI. And so we're, you know, using, of course, in the classroom. We're also looking as a district, you know, operationally, how can we be more efficient by using AI? We are developing a comprehensive AI policy that'll come to our school board in the fall that will help us govern it, you know, the responsible use of AI. 2 years ago, I added it. We have a 5-year strategic plan, and typically you don't change the plan too much during that 5-year span, but I felt AI was a big enough issue that we added a separate AI initiative, and we put a team together to really start working through all the aspects of that.
I wanted to ask about the school board voting earlier this year to repeal diversity, equity, and inclusion language from district policy after being threatened by the Trump administration that it would withhold funding if that language remained. Does that decision at all dictate how teachers can handle discussions about DEI in their classrooms?
You know, as superintendent, I was required by both the US DOE and the Florida Department of Education to sign a certification that we would be in compliance with the Harvard Supreme Court ruling and Title VI as interpreted by the administration. And what that really boiled down to was, we are not permitted to provide a preference for anything based on one's race, ethnicity, or national origin. So that's really it. It was a very narrowly tailored response to make sure that I could sign that certification and not jeopardize $300 million in federal funds. We were very careful not to overcorrect or overcompensate, and that led to 10 policy changes. We still value diversity. We still have an equal opportunity and policy that prohibits discrimination in our hiring. Our mission remains to educate, affirm, and inspire each student in an equity-embedded school system. And we value and appreciate the diversity we have in Palm Beach County. I mean, the short answer to your question, I believe, is no. There has been legislation in Florida, you know, a few years back about that teachers cannot tell students that they must feel guilty based on the actions of their ancestors. Mm-hmm. And that got a lot of publicity. And I think it created some noise where people may have gotten nervous about, well, can I still teach Black history? Can I still teach about the Holocaust or slavery? And the answer is yes, you can absolutely teach those things. We expect you to teach those things. And we continue to do that in Palm Beach County.
You said that it was fear. You were in fear of those funds. Do you also worry that more threats like this could come down the line? And how would you decide when to sweep in and rescue those funds and potentially acquiesce, or when to say no?
So I don't think I said it was fearful. I said that I felt like the threat was valid, that there was a good chance those dollars could be taken. And those dollars funded Title I and IDEA, which are two major entitlement programs that help some of our most vulnerable students. And the recommendation I made was based on the law, based on that, like I said, the Harvard ruling. Title VI is interpreted by the federal administration. So I will continue to follow the law, and hopefully we'll not be in that situation. But I am a constitutional officer along with the school board. And at the end of the day, that's what we're going to have to do, is boil down and say what is legally required.
That was Palm Beach County Public School Superintendent Michael Burke. Finally on the roundup, with a new school year comes new school supplies, and we know those aren't cheap. For families still needing to check off items from their school supplies list, here's a reminder that nonprofit organizations and local governments across all four school districts in this region are having free school supply drives this weekend for those who need them the most. One of them will be held in Palm Beach County's town of Lake Park, where there will be a back-to-school extravaganza event on Saturday. It will include free supplies and resources, including backpacks. And here's another reminder for back-to-school shoppers. For the month of August, parents again are also able to save with the state's sales tax holiday. The tax exemption is only for clothing under $100, school supplies under $50, learning aids under $30, and personal computers and electronics under $1,500. This is the first year the August school supplies tax holiday will be permanent. It will no longer need yearly approval of the Florida legislature. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.